I went to Murray Bertram High, which was really competitive with class clowns. And there was one table at the lunch table that if you were really funny or really good at something, you got to sit at that table. I didn't get to that table till junior year.
It's How to Be Amazing, presented by PRX. I'm Michael Ian Black. Today I'm talking to a performer who, if we consider Hollywood to be like high school, is now definitely sitting at the cool table. John Leguizamo has done many things in his career, including creating award-winning one-man shows, and he's done Shakespeare in the movies, comedy on television, he's sung in kids' movies, and he's even done a graphic novel. And while he will tell you that he had to work hard to get to the cool table, my first impression of him was pretty mind-blowing. I only know him from being at the cool table, because when I was about 20 and living in New York City, I think I just quit college and I was trying to make it myself as an actor. And I remember hearing about a new off-Broadway show called Mambo Mouth. And I don't even know how I could afford tickets, but I did. I got them. And what I remember more than anything watching John Leguizamo was just this guy's energy. You know, in sports, they say someone leaves it all on the field. And that's what I felt like John Leguizamo was doing on stage. I felt like he was trying to win at performing.
Are Latina the 90s, get with the program, mija. Because if it wasn't for a Spanish woman, Columbus would have never discovered America.
25 years later, I am pleased to welcome him to How to Be Amazing. Welcome, John Leguizamo.
Great to be here, man. The reason you could afford it was because it was off-Broadway or off-Broadway. It was way cheaper
than Broadway. It was at the Orpheum on 2nd Avenue.
The last play at the Orpheum since Stomp.
Yeah, but I mean, I didn't have any money then. I really don't know how I got tickets.
I wasn't making any money then. You didn't have any? I wasn't making any.
So can we start with that impression, my impression of you trying to win something? Is that accurate in a way?
I was never trying to win anything. What I was trying to do was be as free. I mean, that's always been my pursuit in my whole life. It's just to be as free as possible. Just to be free, man.
And what did that mean to you?
Freedom and love, man. I've always heard that from bigger performers, always saying it's about love. And I was like, oh, damn, so corny. This whole crunchy granola. And then now that I'm my age, I'm like, yeah, you're right. It is about love. It was about love. It was kind of about finding self-love, you know, like being a Latin man in those times, we were so invisible in the media and so invisible everywhere, and all you saw was negative images of yourself.
Yeah, well, whatever. Anyway, I'm gonna be driving that shit down to my baby's house, honk that horn. She's begging to be my bitch.
No kidding. Hey, Chico.
My name's Chino, man. How many times I gotta tell you? I'm gonna call you homo.
Sorry.
I wanted to pass some of the self-love that I had found through hanging out with great Latin people, great Latin intellectuals, and I wanted to put it out there. And the interesting thing was, I started out, when I first did my show, they didn't really believe in me that much because I was in the hallway of a theater.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't even in a theater, man. And I had to be done before the main show. So I had an hour and 20 minutes or something like that, and I would start at 7, and the main stage show would be at 9, and I had to be done, and all my audience had to be out. 70 fold-up seats. They built a little tiny platform.
And you were talking about the invisibility of Latino and Latina actors, and the impulse to write Mambo Mouth came out of those stereotypical roles you were being offered. How did you make that sort of intellectual leap from going, I'm frustrated with this, and therefore I'm going to write my own shit? Like, were you a writer before that?
You know, strangely enough, I was always writing. I mean, I never considered myself a writer, but I was always writing. I went to Murray Bertram High, which was really competitive with class clowns. And there was one table at the lunch table that if you were really funny or really good at something, you got to sit at that table. I didn't get to that table till junior year.
Yeah, it was like trying, you had to, you know, try out your material in the other eight tables.
Try and work your way up to that table, to the Algonquin round table, as it were. You know, so I started writing my jokes the night before, man.
Did you
files.
Really? You were like preparing for lunch?
Yeah, you have to be, man, because there's no way. It's like people who freestyle rap and they say, I just made that up. You know, they were working on that thing for a century.
I think there's a lot of people like that who are
what?
Funny and can make people laugh, but don't necessarily have the confidence in themselves or even the understanding to go, what I'm doing verbally, I can put down on paper and have that and make that translation into something even theatrical. And I'm just wondering if there's a, if like, was there a moment when you said, I can do this?
I guess the evolution, I never really examined that in my mind, so it's interesting to talk about.
That's why it's a great question, John.
Yeah, it is a great question, man. It is, actually.
Clearly, you're able to walk into a room and just talk.
That's what I learned at Bertram, you know, and hanging out in the streets. You had to be verbally adept, man. You had to have verbal skills if you wanted to be popular or sit in a certain table. You want to have girlies look at you or be with you. And you got to be verbally
adept. It was good for me because I could just rely on my looks, so I didn't have to do anything.
Yeah, I see people like you have that, but I didn't have that, so I had to be verbally skillful. First of all, just to get to be a performer was almost near impossible because you didn't see any Latin people performing except Ricky Ricardo and Freddie Prinze. There were only two of them. My parents were kind of like, we didn't come to this country for you to be worse than us. So that was they were not having my back, and understandably so. You know, they were afraid for my future. And just to get the confidence to just think I could be a performer was a huge inner kind of turmoil of how can I, how dare I, how can I? I'm swimming upstream. I'll be swimming upstream my whole life. And once I got past that, and I got to this acting school with Sylvia Lee, who's passed away now, who's in Ghetto Clown, who I pay a big tribute to all my mentors because that was important. She gave me plays, man, and plays sort of became my entry into writing. I loved plays. There was something about play structure and the language and the poetry of it all that really, really touched my soul. And I knew that, oh, man, just if I could write something like that or be a part, especially when I read Eugene O'Neill's Long Day Journeying Tonight, I was like, this is a miracle.
Jesus, when I think of it, I hate your guts.
Edmund, how dare you talk to your father like that after all I've done for you?
Yeah, we'll come to that, what you're doing for me.
Yeah, and you stop repeating your mother's crazy accusations, which she never makes unless it's the poison talking.
And he's one of the first who ever talked so honestly, so raw about his own family. Mm. Obviously, he didn't want it published till he was dead, which is what I should have done. My one-man shows. I had somebody acting when I was dead.
Oh, okay. Just to draw that parallel between John Leguizamo and Eugene O'Neill, I feel like probably is going to catch a lot of people off guard.
Well, you have to trace it all back to the origins of who was the first person to use literature and talk directly about themselves. Like the first reality show, in a way, is Eugene O'Neill, Long Day's Journey Tonight. Then I had Spalding Gray to look at, who was doing it in a more of a speech, like a talk, and then I took a little piece of everybody. I took a little piece of Lily Tomlin. You know, she was doing a play about these fictional people, and then Eric Bogosian brought the sex and rock and roll to it, and Whoopi Goldberg brought the ghetto poetry. And so I took a little piece of everybody and created my own hybrid of an autobiographical play about yourself. Nobody was doing that.
But then, of course, puberty hit. And I quickly realized that I could have a much better time by myself. Oh, yeah. And I guess I was about 12 years old the first time that I accidentally masturbated. Yeah, because I was just cleaning it and it went off.
Do you remember the process of writing that first show? Do you remember sitting down and writing it?
Yeah. I was in a deep, deep depression, deep funk. I had broken up with this girl that I loved, that I've been with, had been with for like 5 years. And we were a comedy duo. And, you know, we were together and we started writing. We opened up for Rodney Dangerfield. He hit on her and stuff. She was really fine. She was 6'2". Uh-huh. So she made me look like Boris Badenoff.
And he was 62.
Yeah. You're right. And we broke up. And you know, I was really in a deep, deep funk, really depressed. I was mobilized. I was bedridden. You know, I was really depressed. And it was life transforming. After that, I started writing right before I left before I started getting out because I needed food. I started writing that one-man show, but it wasn't a one-man show in my head. It was just a monologue, you know, and then another monologue. And I had like 10 or 15 of them. And then I started performing it. Downtown was great. Downtown New York in that era, the late 80s, was amazing because you could perform everywhere, man.
Right. There were spaces down there in like the Lower
East Village. Yeah, Lower East Side, East Village.
Where, they were called performance spaces. Yeah. I don't know if that even exists anymore.
No, they're gone.
You can't afford it.
I mean, they were everywhere. People just had an apartment on the ground floor, and they would open the door, take the furniture out of the living room,
right.
and people would stand and watch you. It was incredible, man, and charge tickets.
As a kid growing up in Jackson Heights in Queens, were you exposed to theater?
No, not really. I mean, I was taken to see Chorus Line, you know, and that was huge for me because there was a Latin person in the cast who later I started finding out, she helped create, you know, it was a collective creation.
Yeah.
And of course, they all got, you know, collective creation means
they're
going to get screwed, right? Yeah. Michael Bennett, I think, said, you pay a dollar and we'll own the rights or we won't include you. Boom. So they got a dollar for this massive hit that's still out there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's so exploitative. Welcome to America. Yeah, so that was huge for me, seeing that piece of theater. And then after that, I was hooked. Plus, I was reading, dude. I couldn't really afford theater, so, which was great because it forced me to read all these plays because they were free. You know, I could always go to Sylvia Lee or the library, and I was ghetto nerd.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, ghetto nerd. Sorry, mispronounced it.
Well, you grew up in a fairly, at least when you, I guess, first moved into Jackson Heights, Queens. I mean, I don't think people think of that as the ghetto.
It is ghetto. Yeah. I mean, you got the projects all around, you know, Queens Rich projects. I mean, when I got there, we were the first Latin family. And so we were like pioneers and Manifest Destination in Reverse started to happen. And all the Latins people started coming in white flight. You know, it was the late 70s. There was so many gangs, you know, the Latin Top, Savage Skulls, Spiral Sisters, Spades, Tomahawks. And they were all around there. You know, I'd see the colors. Everybody had their colors, colors.
Uh-huh.
Remember that song?
Of course. Was there ever any temptation for you to get involved in that life?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there was a pull, but, you know, I was kind of a punk, and these guys, I thought they were so cool and real tough, and plus the whole retirement plan kind of took me out. You know, like, you have to get beat up to go through the windmill, where you walk through like this, the gang lines up on both sides. You have to walk through, and then they hit you with everything they got.
Right.
And if you make it alive, you're in. And then to leave, it's the same way. They're going to be, now they're really going to hit you with everything. That's their retirement plan. I'm like, nah.
Uh-huh.
I have to get beat up to get in, then I got to get beat up to get out.
I didn't know you could get out. I didn't know there was like a formal, you know.
Oh, you're going to be hurting though,
a
man.
A formal termination procedure. Where
yeah,
you're like,
well,
okay.
You'll be barely alive, but yeah, you'll be, yeah. Wow. They're going to be hurting. I mean, in those days, it was brass knuckles.
And that was the only thing that kept you from joining was just getting beat up. I mean, it would have kept me from joining too.
I wasn't really that good a fighter.
But I mean, to me, that would be like reason to join again, because you would have guys who would have your back.
But they protected me anyway.
Right. Oh, okay.
Because I would do their homework. I did, Ray. I did Ray's homework. He was this handsome kid. He had the biggest afro in the school at IS 145.
Uh-huh.
And all the girls would pretend to go to the bathroom and stand at the door and look at him. And I'd be like, hey, what's up? I'm his friend.
Right. I'm the funny one.
I do his homework. Otherwise, he'd fail and wouldn't be in the school. You owe me.
Your family comes from Colombia. And at a certain point in high school, I guess you were acting out and you were sent back to Colombia for a year.
Yeah.
Now I've read some interviews and seen some interviews with you, but I've never seen you talk about that year in Colombia.
Because it was traumatic, man. I was 14 or something like that. I think I was 14.
First of all, why did they send you back?
Because I was getting into a lot of trouble, man. You know.
What was that trouble?
Oh, it was everything. You know, it was trouble at school. I lost my virginity. Wait, I'm not going to, yeah, I'll give you initials, DD.
Oh, but DD, yeah, say no more, say no more.
I gotten arrested for vandalism because I broke into a Subway car to I thought it was open mic night, and I grabbed the mic, and I got arrested for that.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to my show. Next stop's going to be Jackson Heights. Que cante mi gente.
And I got arrested. I guess it was like my first bad review. And the pulpiggity took me all the way to 110th Street Precinct. Get off me, motherfucker. Yo, I know it looks like a school, but trust me, it ain't. And my parents were so pissed off because they had to take off from work. And my mother comes in, ay, señor policía. Señor policía, he's not a delinquent, no. He's hyper.
And so Colombia was the safer option than New York City at that point.
Yeah, because they would extract me from my neighborhood, extract me from that world, and they put me in this, I mean, money at that time, American dollars went a long way, so they put me in this really high-end school in Colombia where I had no reason being in.
Wait, so where in Colombia were you?
Bogota.
Is this pre-drug wars in Colombia?
I guess so. Yeah, yeah.
Maybe right before?
Yeah, yeah. It must have been like at kind of at the same time kind of thing. Yeah, I mean, they were, you know, the reason my parents came here was because of the fallout of the Civil War, you know, that happened in the 50s.
I'm nodding like I know. I don't know.
No, you know, all of Latin America has that issues of inequality and, you know, the effects of colonialism, which, I mean, colonialism never really goes away, and it creates a destabilization, as we know, in the Middle East. That I mean, part of the reason of all that is we colonize those people, and you colonize them to death, and same thing happened in Latin America, so that's why... You know, Venezuela, Cuba. Well, we stopped Salvador from socializing, because there's no trickle down. Reagan was wrong.
Right.
Only trickle down to happen in Reagan. It was down his leg because he was so damn old.
It's interesting. To me, about the idea of being an immigrant to America and then sort of being sent to Colombia, where you don't really know anybody, and then being an immigrant essentially in your home country.
Yeah, you can't be an artist without being an outsider, without having that bird's eye view of your community, of your society, of your culture. I mean, the only way you can see that is by being an outsider, by always having to look from the outside in.
And did you always feel that sense of being an outsider?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we came here, you know, I didn't really, my parents were foreigners. You know, they were embarrassing to me at first. You know, my English skills weren't as sharp at first, you know, and then they improved, and they sent me to Columbia, and then we moved every year of my life to a different school, different neighborhood, you know, kind of typical actor lifestyle, you know.
Uh-huh. You were just a vagabond from the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you were a kid, what were you thinking long term? Were you thinking about career? Were you thinking how far
Never.
did your vision go for yourself?
You know, when you grow up underprivileged, your vision is like next week.
Uh-huh.
That's it. What am I gonna do next week?
Right. What movies are coming out?
Yeah. There's no plans. I mean, my parents were able to do that. I wasn't able to do that because I was raised here, so I already had a sense of serious limitations. You know, they didn't have that.
Well, what do you mean you had a sense of serious limitations? Because obviously, you know, growing up as I did in America as a white kid, the thing that's instilled in you from the very beginning is you can be anything. I mean, and you don't necessarily believe I can be anything, but you believe that the opportunities are going to be there for you.
Well, growing up
and
as a Latin man, no, I didn't feel that. No, that was them. That was for white people, and my opportunities were very limited.
And was that expressed to you explicitly? Were people
I mean, you do deal with a lot of explicit racism, but you also deal with a lot of implicit sort of code. Mm-hmm. That's given to you, and you absorb that. I mean, that's why I feel like movies and TV and all and textbooks are so important, because it unconsciously tells you who you are. If you watched, I was watching TV all the time and I admired TV and movies, and we weren't there anywhere. So already you got a message that, oh, we're not good enough to have a movie about us. We're not good enough to be in movies.
Hey, Elmo, what's up? How you doing, player?
Hi.
Hey, what are you eating?
Oh, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Just the peanut butter and jelly sandwich?
Yeah.
No green things or crunchy, nutritious kind of Wait a minute. This is a job for Captain Vegetable.
So that idea of... First of all, I have to ask this question because
it's
my ignorance.
This is
I don't understand
show.
The difference between the words Latino or Latina or Latin and Hispanic. Is there a difference?
Yeah, and we're fighting in our own community about that stuff, because Hispanic means you're from Spain, you belong to Spain. So if you're politicized, especially a militant Latin person, you go, that's not cool. We don't belong to anybody. That's our slave name, our colonial heritage. It was called Latin America.
Right.
So that's why we became Latino America. So we took that because it didn't sound like we belonged to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Although Italian people write me tons of tweets or emails saying, you can't be Latino. Latin comes from Italy. You're not Roman. If you were Roman, then you would be Latin. I'm like, get a sense of humor. Grow up.
Right.
Let us have something. You got everything. Shut up.
Give us something. Give us this. So Latino or Latin is now sort of the preferred.
Yeah.
All right.
By us, you know.
But
by you know, intellectuals, artists.
And is that expanding? I mean, I mean, when you hear the word Hispanic, does that sound like a slur now?
In my ear, it does. But, you know, and for the regular Latin people, I don't think so.
All right.
They just feel like they're being acknowledged. But I think for the people who are politicized and thought about it, yeah.
When I have to check the race box on forms, I always get freaked out because I'm like, I mean, I don't know what am I really? I don't know what to check. I don't want to check Hispanic because that's our slave name. We don't belong to Spain no more. And I'm not white enough. I'm not black enough. I'm not native enough. But I have all of them inside me. So I check other and I write in Vulcan.
When did you become politicized? When did the politics of being Latin start to inform you?
I guess it started to happen for me like in my mid-20s, you know, after college, after NYU, you know. I was always the only Latin person in my acting classes with Wynn Hanman and Lee Strasberg, Herbert Berghoff. I studied with some of the greats, but I was always the only Latin person, which was very encouraging and very, very disappointing at the same time, you know? I started meeting some Latin people who were politicized because there was a big, huge political movement in the 60s in New York, the Young Lords. And these were all really college-educated, really smart. They became journalists and reporters. My next show, Latin History for Dummies, comes out of that because I started doing a lot of research. And I go, wait a minute, we discovered this country, we explored this country, we settled it. Half the country has Spanish names: Florida, Nevada, Colorado, Arizona, and we were here during the Revolutionary War and helped out. And we had generals, and it's never talked about. In the Civil War, 10,000 Latin people participated
on both sides.
Yeah. Well, we'll go wherever they pay us, you know. 500,000 Latin people fought in World War II. I mean, you never hear about that in any of those movies that Spielberg makes or HBO. You never hear that. But 500,000 people is a huge contribution to the making of this country. And From Here to Eternity was written about a Mexican guy.
Really?
But you would never know it because it's played by a white guy, mm-hmm. Frank Sinatra.
Are those stories lost even among...
Oh, yeah, Latin History for Dummies is for everybody. It's not just for white people. It's mostly for Latin kids. I mean, eventually I want to do that show in colleges and high schools. And so I'm trying to make it as funny as possible because, you know, history lesson is not the most fun thing for a kid.
And you're doing it in comedy clubs.
Yeah, I'm doing it in comedy clubs right now.
Had you spent any time in comedy clubs really before that?
Not really, no. I love comedians, but I didn't really love the set up joke. Contract of a comedy club. I wanted to tell stories, man. I wanted to see characters. I love more Nichols and May. That's the things I loved. Stiller and Mira, you know. And then, you know, eventually the one-man show is a format that I really love because it's sort of a contract with the audience and it's all imagination. I mean, I'm there by myself, but I'm taking you places. You're seeing people that are not up there. You're seeing me become other people. It's a great exercise between the two of us, an audience and a performer.
I mean, I'm just getting off the road, and I never did comedy clubs either until the last few years. And
what did you do?
Well, I was never a stand-up. I started in sketch comedy.
Right.
And then eventually,
your acting skills.
Yeah, and then eventually start and always admired stand-ups, but never sort of thought I would be one. Then I started getting offers to do it, and I was like, yeah, I like money. I'll try doing it.
Yeah.
But it was a huge leap of faith for me to feel like I could get over in a comedy club.
Right. When I first started, I would have never been able to create my shows in a comedy club because I'm used to having total freedom emotionally, structurally, content-wise. But there's an unwritten code that when you enter the comedy club, this motherfucker better make me laugh.
Yeah.
And he better make me laugh
It is called a comedy club. I would say it is written.
Yeah.
Say it's unwritten.
But the written law is that it's got to be every... JPM's got to come.
Yeah.
Every minute. So there's this, if you drop that JPM, jokes per minute thing, you feel the energy really drop. And we have to work, because first of all, they're talking, they're drinking, they're eating.
Mm-hmm. And now that me and Titi had two kids, she was tired all the time. And so responsible, man. Warming bottles for the kids at 6 a.m., mine at 8. And it's not that I wanted sex all the time. Nah, it's just she was so tense, I felt she needed it. All right, this is my story, and I'm sticking to it.
So I used every trick in the book. Here, Teeny, I brought you an aspirin, baby.
Yeah, but I don't have a headache.
Aha! Aha!
So now that you're doing this new show in comedy clubs, are you feeling like you're losing something?
Yes, but I'm gaining a lot. I'm gaining a lot because there's no way that this is going to be, all this history is going to be palatable mm-hmm. to anybody unless it's ridiculously funny. And so the pressure of having so many JPMs makes it really palatable. And I want this history lesson to really, you know, comedy is the best way to smuggle information, I always felt.
We'll be right back with more from John Leguizamo. I'm back with performer John Leguizamo. After Ghetto Clown, I think, and maybe even before that, you said you were done with one-man shows, that it was too exhausting, it took too much out of you.
Sexaholics. It was Sexaholics. I think it was Sexaholics. Because I had a lot of emotional... I had a David Chappelle, if we can start calling that within the industry. You're a comedian, so you understand. I mean, the pressure that you start to create of yourself, for yourself, you start thinking that I have to be the funniest. I got to be that all the time. I got to be perfect.
Right.
And you short circuit, you know, and you blow a fuse, and that happened to me. You know, I couldn't do it anymore. I was full of like performance anxiety, fear of failure, and I couldn't do it. I was terrified.
And so at that time, what did you do?
I didn't perform.
How did you diagnose? I mean, you didn't perform at all? Not in film.
I did do films. I was safe in films. I felt there was no audience. There was no pressure. I wasn't writing it. I wasn't creating it.
You could just show up.
Yeah, I could just show up.
Do you like that? Do you like not being the writer sometimes?
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Because then I just work on my acting. You know, just you know, it comes naturally to me, the acting part.
What reignited that flame to get back up, to get up on a stage?
I lucked out somehow. Like you, I got asked to do college talks, and so I didn't know what I was going to talk about. I was petrified, but I thought it's just a talk, you know. So I took index cards of my career and you know, had little bits in each one, and I had to drink a lot to get out on stage, lubricate myself to get some confidence.
And, really.
Yeah, I was mad terrified.
That would make me more scared if I'd been drinking.
I imbibed and you know, used substance, but it never turned out good. But I needed it. I couldn't go on stage I couldn't go to that podium without it.
And it helped.
Yeah, I was.
I mean,
loose,
young actors listening,
care.
Listen up.
No, drink a little. No, I think. Well, yeah, I think as a writer, I used to drink to loosen up at night.
Mm-hmm.
That helped. I mean, you wrote a lot of gibberish, but there was a lot of poetry in there, too.
Mm-hmm.
You just had to distill it.
So you get back on stage with Ghetto Clown, and Ghetto Clown is...
Oh, so wait. So I started doing the talk, and these kids gave me this crazy standing ovation at the end. They were laughing, and I was like, wow, there's something here. And I ran home quickly before I passed out and started writing down the things that I had said. And then I started saying, you know, send me out to more of these. So I did that for like 2 to 3 years. Till I got the confidence, till it became a bit, and I started getting more and more confident. Then I dropped the alcohol, and then I said, you know, I'm ready. I want to start going to theaters, and I was nervous mad nervous at first, and then I started, you know, my confidence started coming back, and it was great.
The question I get a lot is from young actors who can't conceive of ever making a living doing this is, how did you know when you made it? And to them, I've made it. To me,
yeah.
No, not even close. You know what I mean? But at the same time, as I've aged, I feel like I've relaxed into a kind of peace with where I am.
Yeah.
And with where I'm going.
Right. I agree. That finally happened. That coin finally dropped. But it took forever, man. You know, even when I won the Emmy, immediately I felt like I wasn't good enough, you know?
Yeah.
Otherwise I would have got both Emmys. But it was always this crazy battle in my head, you know?
Did having kids and remarrying, did that have anything to do with it, do you think?
Oh, definitely my wife brings a lot of peace to my life, you know? She definitely does. She's so she's my rock of Gibraltar. She's so steady and so calm, and she doesn't have any of those demons that I have. And she lets me be. She lets me have my demons and be and pursue what I have to. If I have to go write, because I feel like I have to write almost every day, you know, just to feel sane. And so she lets me go to my man cave, and I go there and I write whatever it is, or watch porn, which I think we writers call it writing, right?
One of the things I really like about you is that you are kind of unafraid to say these kinds of raw truths about not only your life, which I think is really helpful, but also just like calling out people in the industry who are dicks, which I feel like is very rare. And I'm not going to ask you to recount those stories, because if you want to hear them, you can go online and find them.
Go ahead, what did Steven Seagal do to you?
We were in rehearsals for Executive Decision, okay? I'm playing his master sergeant, and we come in for rehearsals, and he comes in. I'm in command. What I say is law. Anybody doesn't agree? And I was like, I started cracking up because he sounded like a retard. And he came up, and he taekwondoed my ass against the brick wall. He's 6'5" and caught me off guard, knocked all the air at me. I was like, why? Why? What I really want to say is how big and fat he is, how he runs like a girl. Cause he
okay.
Is that conscious on your part? Is like the sort of like, I'm an open book. Is that a conscious decision?
It was. I don't know if I'm going to be like that anymore. I mean, it was definitely, I always wanted to be transparent as possible. I mean, that was my freedom. That was my freedom of expression. And I had to be like that in high school to get to that table. I had to be as free as possible. My household was very, you know, it was so dictatorial in my house that's always kind of like what I've been running away from, sort of the oppression that was in my house and in the streets. And I wanted total freedom. And that's why I always, you know, Richard Pryor and Lenny Bruce, those comics who just said everything as raw as possible. There's such a beauty in that. There's such a open book. It's such a beautiful thing to be.
You say your household growing up was dictatorial. The clips that I've seen where you're talking about your parents, and it sounds like they were both pretty big personalities. And so who was the dictator?
My dad. I mean, yeah, he was the patriarch of the family, and what he said was
the law.
He hablado. Uh-huh. I have spoken, you know, and I couldn't, you know, I wasn't allowed to say what, you know, like if my dad called me for something, you couldn't say what. I had to say, sir. Hmm. Like, John, bring me that beer. What? What? Get. And he'd be right at you at your face. And I go, no, I mean, sir.
And was that him specifically, or was that also cultural?
It was him. I mean, there's a little bit of cultural, you know, back. It was also back in the day, you know, so. Mm-hmm. That was kind of universally all around the world. You know, kids were meant to be seen and not heard.
How were you able to sort of recognize that for yourself so that you didn't perpetuate it moving forward?
Well, therapy, you know, therapy. I was forced to go to therapy with Mrs. Buxenbaum, who was so hot, and she would wear leather pants. Yeah. She was so sexy.
But when was this that you were forced to go to therapy?
In high school. I had to go for 4 years of high school. Otherwise, I wouldn't be allowed back. So I went there, you know, begrudgingly. And then all of a sudden, I was like, I want therapy twice a week. I want to see those leather pants again.
And you found that helpful to be with Mrs. Buxenbaum?
Yeah. I told you that. She was incredible, man. It helped me figure myself out, sort of stop being so self-sabotaging. And that's where I got the courage to go to acting school, you know. There was all these people. I mean, when you come from a background like I do, you need mentors, man. And that's why I try to give back, too. You need people to come in and somebody to intervene on your behalf and say, you are worth it. You can do this. You have value. And Mrs. Buxenbaum, my math teacher, Mr. Zufa, my stepmom. And, you know, because my mom was always like that, too. So there was a lot of people.
When did the impetus to move from acting, writing, to producing, directing, all of that happen?
I think pretty early on. I mean, because I was aware of
Hollywood. You did House of Buggin pretty early.
Yeah. Because Hollywood was so evident to me. You know what I mean? There was a plexiglass ceiling that I couldn't get through, and I knew that. You know,
but you must have had opportunities. I mean, Mambo Mouth comes out.
Right.
And if I know anything about Hollywood or Hollywood, as you say, it's that you know, all the leeches come and they say, what blood can I suck from this?
Yeah, yeah.
So there must have been nothing but meetings.
TV.
And
TV came to me like crazy. They wanted me to be the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. They wanted me to do this and that. But I came from a pedigree of acting teachers that in a time where TV was looked down upon, you know, I turned it all down because, you know, I came from studying with some of the great acting teachers in the world. The film in the theater, that's what I was dying for.
Hey, Mr. Brigante, it's the second time you turned me down for a drink, man. What, you don't like my champagne?
Hey, it could be.
I don't know, maybe it's a misfucking understanding here. I don't know, man. Maybe you don't remember me. My name is
maybe
Benny.
Maybe I don't give a shit. Maybe I don't remember the last time I blew my nose either.
So then why House of Buggin'?
I got talked into it. You know, I got talked into it. And then, but the thing I loved about it was I was going to create like a Latin version of Saturday Night Live, which had never pursued a Latin talent. So I was going to do it. And you know, I we did all right. You know, I guess I mean, Fox came to me. I mean, I know Latin and black people were really loving the show, but you know, we weren't really included in the Nielsen's back in the 94.
You mean Fox wasn't? Or what do you mean you weren't?
The Nielsen ratings.
Yeah, but I know, but what
they
do you
didn't
mean
really count Latin and black families as much as they should have. The equal percentage of the population.
Oh, I see. You're saying Nielsen itself was undercounting minority families,
yes,
minority households.
Yep.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Latin from Manhattan, loving you like satin, John Leguizamo. What's up, Latino people in the house, say ho! Black people in the house say hey. Jewish people in the house say, is he Sephardic?
And then they told me if I would fire my cast, they would keep the show and I would populate it with all these white actors and whatever. And I was like, you know, I was a proud, loyal kind of type of dude. I always have been to a fault. And I said, no. I said, it's either my way or the highway. So they said, see ya. Route 09 is that way. And so they kept, you know, they kept my writers, my directors that I found, the producers, one of the white actor from the cast, and they called it Mad TV.
Well, that sucks.
Sort of, yeah. You know, everybody's got a tale like that. I'm not the only one.
My tales aren't quite like that. I mean, because obviously I never had to deal with the racial component of it. But, I mean, you know, my career's been just, you know, one shitty speed bump after another.
Well, come on. He's like coughing it up. He's like, come on, stop being vague.
Well, the most painful was...
Yeah, that's what I want to hear. Thank you. Welcome and to John Leguizamo's podcast.
No.
We're going to find out.
No, we'll just cut it out. The most painful... was right after my son was born. He was maybe one. I got a call saying Pixar wants you to be a voice in their new movie, Finding Nemo.
Wow.
And I'm like, wow, you know. And I go,
cha-ching.
Yeah, oh, of course. All I'm thinking about is residual checks. But I'm also thinking this is going to be amazing because when this comes out, my son will be old enough
to
be able to see it.
Sweet.
So I go in and they want me to record the character of this turtle named Crush, who's like this surfer dude.
Mm-hmm.
And mentally I'm thinking to myself, I have no idea why you selected me to do this, but I'm thrilled that you did. The director is, I think Andrew Stanton is his name. I think that's who directed it. He's in a booth in LA, but there's a video hookup and I can see him and he's sort of doing line readings to sort of let me know kind of what he's looking for. And I remember thinking to myself, you're good at this.
Yeah, yeah.
You should be this character, but I'm not going to say that. And I do it and everybody loves it and I leave. And as I'm leaving and I get to my car, there's a parking ticket on my car. And I should have known that that was an omen.
Oh, man, a sign.
Yeah, because a few months later, I get a call. Bad news. The character's not working, so the character's being cut from the movie. And
man,
I'm devastated. Then I see the trailer. The character is in the trailer.
Yeah.
I'm listening, and I'm like, I think that's my voice.
Oh, they stole your voice. You stole your characterizations?
Well, I call. And I'm like, can you find out what's going on? They're like, the director ended up revoicing the turtle. So Andrew Stanton, the director, ended up revoicing. But to my own ear, it sounded like we were doing the same exact thing.
Yeah.
I'm not saying he stole anything from me. Because when I heard him in the booth, I'm like, dude, you're really good at this.
Yeah.
But
who came up with the voice first? Did you do it first and he made it better or?
It's hard to say. I mean, he sort of described it as he wanted Keanu Reeves in Point Break kind of thing.
Oh, right. So you knew that you had to do it.
He
like
had an idea, right. And
do
and,
us a little give us a little taste.
Don't you
dude.
Can't.
Come on. Shaha.
Yeah, that's
radical, man. Yeah.
So that was the most painful.
Oh, God.
Dude. That kind of thing.
That was good. That was good, man.
Thanks, buddy.
I turned down Happy Feet.
You turned it down?
Yeah.
Why?
Oh, I felt like I was in one Ice movie. I didn't want to be in there so stupid.
So it was the Ice linkage that made you turn it down.
I'm being redundant. I'm like, I'm such an idiot.
They're gonna peg me as the Ice voice actor.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, man, I'm going to be pigeonholed. The Latin Ice actor. He can only do Ice movies. Oh, Jesus Christ.
That's so funny.
What an idiot.
What's up, my mammals? This is Sid the Sloth from the movie Ice Age, and we're about to do this new dance, the Continental Drift. It's time to get up on your feet. It's easy to do. Just follow me. Move it out. Do the sit. Take it back. And do the sit.
How important is money to you as you make your way in your career?
You know, it never was. Money was never, fame was never an important thing. None of that nonsense was a part. But now that you have kids and a life, yeah, it's kind of important. The business has really changed. I mean, ever since the crash, the Great Recession.
Right.
You know, everything, you know, studios found a way of like really
cutting back
salaries on everybody. You know, they just pay one guy and then everybody eats, you know, a shit sandwich and you better like it. And I do, sir. Tasty. A little more mayo.
I feel like, and I feel like I've heard you say that the opportunities for Latin actors, for black actors, Asian actors have grown.
Oh yeah. Big time. You know, all of a sudden, something really happened, finally really happened a few years back. And I think it's the digital world has really created an egalitarian world in so many ways because things can really be measured. Things, inaccuracies can be really found. And now, you know, the numbers of Latin people in this country is precise. If we're not being counted, it's you know, there are people speaking out against that, you know, and they found out that, you know, we have over $1 trillion of buying power just in the United States. And they found out that we go to the movie theater more than any other minority. We go in large groups. We go often. They know what we like. You know, like Ice Age knew that Latin families love Ice Age.
Right.
And they like to see their own in movies.
Hey, you want to work for me, huh? You want to beat people up for me?
Sure.
All right. Let's get you a mask and a costume and we will call you Black Death.
Whoa, you don't think that's just a little bit incredibly racist?
I want you to Before I let you go, Ghetto Clown, your show, you recently made into a graphic novel.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's a work of art, man.
It is. It's gorgeous.
It's so beautiful.
I have it, and it's gorgeous. And I guess the immediate question is why? Why did you do it?
Because it was the most comprehensive of my work, the most complete. It took me 8 years to crack the career paradigm on stage, because people had tried, Kirk Douglas had tried, a lot of people had tried telling their career story on stage, but it's really difficult, man. It took me 8 years to crack it because it's got to have the right ingredients and the right ratio of adulation and self-flagellation, and you got to be really ready to be ridiculously honest. And also, Ghetto Clown was my first show that I also, it traveled through so much time, so much space. I did more characters per scene instead of just the two talking back and forth. And I felt like I know it could be a great graphic novel, man. Graphic novels are in such a beautiful place right now with Persepolis, Fun Home, Diary of a Teenage Girl. I mean, they're not just about superheroes.
All right, as we round the corner towards home, the last thing we do here on How to Be Amazing is called The Amazing Five. I will ask you for a recommendation in each of five categories.
Recommendation of
anything that
restaurants?
We'll start with food. Sure. Food is one of the categories.
Oh, I love Ethiopian food.
Ethiopian?
Yeah. Turkish food, Indonesian food, Puerto Rican food.
Do you have a specific Ethiopian restaurant in New York City that you would recommend to people?
Oh, Meskerem. Meskerem on McDougal. Oh, so good.
All right.
I go there all the time.
Yeah. On McDougal. Books, a book you would recommend.
Oh man. Right now I'm reading so many teenage help books. That's not the ones I want to recommend. Oh, you know, I just reread This Is Our Youth.
Oh, yeah?
And I'm rereading Our Town. Yeah, plays. You're right. I still love reading plays. Yeah, I don't know why.
What, is there a reason you're rereading Our Town?
I just remember it being so powerful and so beautiful and so simple. And
it is, right?
And it is, man. It's just so, with very little props and very little dramatic tricks or aerobics, you get all this empowering emotion. I wanted to study the simplicity of that.
Music.
Oh, that's a lot easier. Miles Davis, Something Kind of Blue.
Great.
Funny All Stars, something by, Funny All Stars was an incredible amalgamation of the greatest musicians of the time who were cross-pollinating with jazz musicians in the 70s in New York and the birth of salsa. And they recorded these albums, and it was like an all-star thing. Oh my God, the music is just makes the hair stand on your neck. I mean, I love Kendrick Lamar.
Uh-huh.
I like Drake. I ain't gonna lie.
People feel self-conscious about liking Drake. Why?
Because, you know...
Because he's popular?
Yeah, pop, man. I don't know. Pop music is always kind of an embarrassing thing to like.
Right.
You know.
Kendrick Lamar's pop, though, isn't he? He's popular.
But he's got a little more edge. I mean, Drake is very experimental within his pop, which is what I appreciate.
Movies.
Now or of
any,
all time?
Any that you would... give me one.
Well, I'll
that
give you
love.
The seasons. Let me give you the seasons. I got all my screeners and I've watched most of them already.
All right.
So I really dug Black Mass.
Haven't seen it.
Oh, yeah, man. It was pretty cool. Although,
I've got my screener.
Johnny Depp's face, you know, he's trying... that too much makeup stuff is a little distracting, but he does a great performance, man. Diary of a Teenage Girl. I mean, it reads better. It's a little more difficult to see it as a movie when you have flesh and blood being a 15-year-old girl having an affair with a 40-year-old man. That gets a little weird. It's different in a graphic novel. You kind of forgive it because it's just stick figures.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little weird. But it's still brilliant. Me, Earl, and the Dying Girl. Straight Out of Compton.
Mm-hmm.
Was fantastic.
And then finally, and this is the one that everybody struggles with, Miscellaneous, which is just anything from your life that you would recommend to
from
other
my
people.
Life?
Yeah, anything.
Well, I recommend my boxing coach.
There you go.
Gennaro Diaz.
How long have you been boxing?
25 years.
Really?
Yeah. And he just like gets all the tension out of me, makes me feel confident. I don't know. I get all the violence out. It makes me peaceful. He's such a gentle human being. I don't know. I learned a lot from him. He's like my Sifu.
Have you ever sparred, like really gone
at
it with somebody?
I don't like getting hit, brother. I don't like getting hit. No. I just do not. No, I have friends who like getting hit, man.
Really?
They feel alive. They feel adrenaline.
Oh,
and I'm
God.
Like, nah, man, I just feel pain.
Yeah.
I feel like I want to run the other way. And I got beat up by girls in the ring. Oh, it's all embarrassing and humiliating. Not that girls can't be powerful, but yeah, you know.
No, I get it.
Yeah, but it was, you know, she's embarrassed. She embarrassed the hell out of me.
Right. Well, boxing. So that's a great recommendation.
Oh, I love it. I love
great
it.
Great
yeah,
recommendation.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, John Leguizamo, thank you so much for coming in, taking the time, and thank you for being amazing.
Thank you, brother. Thank you for being amazing.
How to Be Amazing is brought to you by PRX. Like How to Be Amazing on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @HTBA_show and check out our website at howtobeamazingshow.com. If you like what you've heard, please write us a nice review on iTunes. How to Be Amazing is produced by Jennifer Brennan and Mary Shimkin. It's recorded at Argo Studio in New York City. Today's show is mixed and edited by Robin Lynn with music composed by Chad Crouch. Post-production work was also done by Barry O'Halloran. I'm Michael Ian Black.